Hello, and thank you for choosing this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. Hello to everyone who has become a regular listener, and there's quite a lot of you. It's very heartening to see the audience growing in that way. We must be doing something right. And if this is your first time listening, then welcome. I'm sure you'll be glad you found us. This is a bit of a special episode, as it is the end of the year, a time when life as a practitioner is less about InfoSec and more DemiSec, when the security you have to worry about is on the door of the pub or club you're trying to get into, and the only CIA on your mind is whether you get caught in the act at the office party. But to reflect that lighter tone, we're not going to be talking directly about information security, but we'll be talking about books to do with InfoSec, cyber, and IT. My name is Mark Ward. I'm a senior research analyst at the ISF, and I'm a bit of a bibliophile, and I'm really looking forward to talking about one of my defining passions. I'm not alone. I'm joined by a whole gaggle of book nuts, if they don't mind me talking about them like that. We've got here Mark Chaplin, a principal at the ISF and an inveterate book reader. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Mark. Glad to be here. Looking forward to it.
Good to have you. There's Paul Watts, a distinguished analyst at the ISF who also reads and reads and reads.
Yeah, and I've just finished Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Seuss, so I'm ready to level up now. So looking forward to getting some good pointers on my next bookie wook.
The Very Hungry Caterpillar. It's a classic.
Perfect. Thank you, mate.
And completing the lineup is Alice Violet, our AV expert who usually edits this podcast, but she helps other cyber organizations make podcasts and other media and has a long history in the sector. Hello, Alice.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Exciting to be in front of the mic this time.
Indeed. Good. Great to have you here. So do you know what occurred to me just now is that this is like getting like Congress, where all of us were involved with getting that podcast done on the main stage. So are we getting the band back together? Are we Fleetwood Mac Carpenters or perhaps a more modern equivalent? I don't know.
Well, it's nice to be back. Take that.
Who's going to be Robbie?
No comment.
Esther's Robbie because she's left. Anyway, yes, maybe moving on. The format for this episode is that we have all chosen a book and we'll now go around and briefly talk about those and field questions and comments from everybody. So we'll start with Mark Chaplin. Mark, you've chosen Cybersecurity First Principles by Rick Howard. That sounds kind of serious. Is it a bedtime book?
So this is an interesting one for me because despite the industry that we work in, cyber books are not the most common type of book that I read. So I'll give you an introduction, then maybe explore a little bit what caught my attention, why I've read it, and why I'm actually talking about the book on this podcast, because I think it's got a lot of really important content in it. So first of all, it's written by Rick Howard, who is the chief analyst and senior fellow at the CyberWire podcast network. So very, very familiar with podcasts. I've actually messaged him last night to say you should be on the podcast. So maybe we'll explore that next year, Mark. But he's also been a chief security officer for a number of high-profile tech companies. And he's also been a commander for the U.S. Army's Computer Emergency Response Team. And he makes some references to that in the book. But I think the important thing is he also set up something called the Cybersecurity Canon Hall of Fame. So he's very familiar with a lot of the books that, you know, all of us have probably read over the last, you know, decade, maybe a couple of decades. He's incredibly well connected and he knows his stuff. But why did I actually read this book? Well, first of all, it was brought to my attention by a comment that Doug Hubbard had made on LinkedIn when Rick published the book early this year. And secondly, when I started reading the book, I realized that he was focusing on what he sees as the first principle of cybersecurity, which is to reduce the probability of material impact to an organization due to a cyber event. And interestingly enough, that reflects our two primary objectives of risk management, which is reduce the frequency of loss events occurring, you know, the bad stuff happening, try and reduce that as much as possible. And the second is to reduce impact, typically financial impact to an organization. So there was already a synergy there between his thinking and what he wrote about in the book. And really what, you know, we're trying to help our members within the ISF achieve and why they're members. So first of all, first principles, that caught my attention because as we know, you know, first principles is about critical thinking. It's about breaking complex things down to their sort of atomic level and then you can build solutions up from that. And I think that's really important because, you know, if you go back to Aristotle, he applied this principle. And then you look at sort of recent business leaders like Elon Musk and Charlie Munger, they also apply those principles. So the concept of, you know, reverse engineering the challenges that, you know, we're experiencing, our organizations in the membership are experiencing, is really important. And that's what you do, Mark, in the research team in ISF, is to apply these principles. So really, just to summarize the book, Rick proposes five strategies which underpin these first principles. Zero trust, which is about doing security properly. Intrusion kill chain prevention, which is very similar to the ISF cyber attack chain. It's about understanding how threats, you know, cyber attackers work. Thirdly, resilience, which is the number one priority for every organization that we work with. Risk forecasting, which is really where Rick's, you know, identified some of the sort of forward thinking predominantly around Douglas Hubbard's work. And finally, automation, which I think is still in an embryonic stage, but, you know, in order to meet some of the sophisticated challenges that we face as organizations, you need to automate that. And then finally, in summary, the reason why I really like this book, it's chock full of facts, history of cyber, the origins of capabilities. It's splashed with humor and anecdotes, which, you know, keep you reading. And there's some cool statistics in there that I think any cybersecurity professional can have up their sleeve. Certainly helps them engage with the business, engage with executives, etc. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of an idea of what that book covers. And yeah, it was just a really good read. I've got my team reading it now. It's a really good primer, I think, for how organizations should be approaching cybersecurity.
I wonder, does it move things on, or is it just sort of summarize what the sort of feelings within PSEC as a kind of discipline, I suppose?
I think it puts a stake in the ground to explain how we got to where we are today. Right. But I think more importantly, he takes the conversations around risk forecasting, risk analysis, and applying some of the more progressive approaches and techniques, such as, you know, modeling, simulations, Monte Carlo, etc. Even Bayes' theorem he covers in it. But the important thing is he actually shows the thinking behind how you would actually apply this in practice in an organization. And it's very similar to a lot of the work that, you know, that I do and my team does. And so, yeah, I think it sets, you know, it provides the next step forward in how organizations should be bringing all these things together. So, yes, I think it brings people, certainly if you don't have a background in cybersecurity, it will bring you up to an adequate level of understanding of, you know, where we are today, and then proposes how we should move forward.
I was just curious about, you know, I've read a lot of GRC, governance, risk and compliance books in my time, and I always think that they come at it from a particular direction, which is it's all about managing risk down. What about, does the book cover in any way the notion that actually risk management can be gamed to drive competitive advantage, and actually risk should be something that should be tamed and managed rather than something that should be controlled and put in a box? Does it look at it from that angle at all, Mark?
Yeah, I think Rick's background is very much technical in nature. So there is a majority of content which is technical in nature. I think, you know, how he suggests how these things should be brought together, how you collect metrics, how you take a more data-centric approach and how you apply it is important. It certainly reflects a lot of our thinking around, if you get this right, you're going to be in a much stronger position as a security or a risk leader in engaging with executives, business leaders, the board of directors, etc. So he certainly touches on that. And I actually think it's a really good step forward to bring a majority of technology, information and cyber professionals, specialists, for want of a better term, how to help them get to a point where they're going to be in a stronger position to make that engagement. So, you know, a lot of the work that we're doing, Paul, as you know, is focused more on business engagement, alignment with an organization's broader approach to managing other risks like political risk, contract risk, project risk, credit risk, all of those different types of risk. So I think it certainly is, it's going to help organizations get there. And he certainly alludes to the fact, you know, if you make a statement such as, we're trying to help the organization reduce the probability of these events occurring and thereby reducing the material impact of the organization, you're naturally talking business language. You're naturally trying to help the organization pursue its goals and objectives and strategy while trying to manage a broad range of risks, which includes cyber.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like the kind of thing I should be reading, because I'm certainly conscious that I need, my knowledge is in small silos, and there's, yeah, if there's something out there that can link it all up, that would be useful. Yeah, it sounds like a good one to check out.
I suppose the standout thing there is, I advocate any kind of thought leadership that insinuates that risk management can be a progressive discipline rather than just a methodology that has to be followed and cannot deviate from its current path. And, you know, that, so that interconnection to, you know, business outcome and a more dynamic approach to how risk management should be conducted is something to be applauded. So, you know, any book that advocates that you can think differently, you don't just have to follow the principles that are cast in stone, is it always gets a tick in the box for me.
Yeah, there's also a lot of myth busting in it, and there's quite a few statistics in there that really bring home sort of the true nature of what the cyber threat looks like, and who we should be worrying about, and who are our external partners out there, whether it's law enforcement or the tech giants, you know, some of the things that they're doing to try and help us as organizations manage that threat. But ultimately, there are a lot of takeaways in there at a technical, operational, and business level.
Yeah, because that's certainly something we worry about with Threat Horizon, is, are we focusing on the wrong people? I mean, we can say worry about these things, but I think there's a lot of people in the trenches who worry about very, very different types of threats, and yeah, they're the ones that are going to much more likely to catch them out, for sure. So moving on then, Alice, to go to you next. And you have chosen The Age of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff. What's that all about?
Yeah, so I was introduced to this book actually when I was working on another podcast, and Deborah Webster was the guest on that podcast, and she really recommended people read it. And it definitely isn't a light bedtime read. It's very dense. Yeah, it's hefty, and it's also very academic in tone. And that's my only criticism of it, because I do feel like it's the kind of book that really everybody should read. But I think that the language could probably be combative to a lot of people reading it. And basically, the book examines how big tech companies like Google, Meta, and Microsoft harvest our personal data for profit. And one of the things that surprised me is that it's not the data that they're selling, it's the behavioral insights and powerful advertising abilities that are for sale. So my assumption on what this book was about and what it actually offered was different. So I assumed that existing infrastructure like roadside cameras were correlating with data from these huge data sets from places like Google. But actually, Google Earth, satellites, our phone data, and social media platforms have way more intricate detail about us than any of these existing infrastructures that I was sort of thinking were going to be mentioned. The book's backed by extensive research, and it's all about the kind of critical lack of public awareness and regulation. And one of the things that stood out to me, especially as we're in the lead up to Christmas, are things like smart toys that you have in children's homes, things like cameras within our houses, TVs, all these kind of smart fridges, smart cars, everything. And I think that we assume a level of trust from retailers. So like, I would assume that if I saw a toy, a doll, for example, in a supermarket, I had a level of trust that supermarket wouldn't stock something that wasn't adequately security protected. But actually, a lot of them aren't. A lot of these very intrusive smart devices don't have adequate security protection. And so if it is in your children's bedroom, for example, being voice controlled, unfortunately, a lot of that data is easily hackable. And in the terms and conditions, which are hefty, which nobody reads, it does say that this data is to be shared infinitely with third parties and things like that. So it covers a huge, broad spectrum of information, because it also gives examples from like Nazi Germany of like how behavior can be influenced and changed. And this is just another example of this on an enormous scale.
Yeah, because that's the other side of this. They're not just harvesting information about us, but they're trying to manipulate us as well. I mean, suddenly that's where we are with a lot of the algorithms. I read something really quite disturbing the other day, which was this woman who's a teenager, and she was talking about what algorithms have done to my generation. And she was, you know, laying out in pretty stark terms about the ways that the algorithm gradually steers you to the extremes of almost any topic. So if you're a young woman, it's hardly surprising that, you know, there's a lot of body image problems there because because of where they get steered by those algorithms and those filters and things like that. And the same with young men as well, so young boys. They get steered to all kinds of things that, you know, they were vaguely interested in, but suddenly the algorithm thinks, oh, this is your lifestyle, this is what you're going to be now as well. I think that's definitely a dangerous side to it as well.
And that's why I think it's so important that people read it, because she mentions habituation and how this just becomes normalized to all of us, and how things like Google Maps, Google Earth, there's a huge example with Pokemon Go in terms of marrying the virtual and real worlds together so that there is no difference. And I think the risk is with the younger generation that we can kind of see that shift, even though it's happening in front of us. And until I read this book, I wasn't so acutely aware of it. But the risk is that the younger generation are going to be even less aware of it. And it becomes a problem when that behavioral data is used to influence democracy, politics, as we saw with Cambridge Analytica. And I think, you know, it's just a huge thing that I think more people need to be aware of.
Yeah, and I don't think they are. I think they just accept, they've kind of feel, certainly my in-laws, who are quite old, admittedly, but, you know, I've had a conversation with them about the spam email messages they get, and they treat them like letters through the post. They sort of, why, this lovely company has written to me with this particular article. It's like, no, they're not lovely. They haven't picked you out. They're just trying to catch you out. And that was quite a difficult conversation to have. But I think you're right. It becomes the water in which people swim, and they just don't see it in that respect. Paul, you've got kids. I mean, did you worry about what surveillance capitalism is doing to them?
I worry about it constantly for a number of different reasons. But I have an interest in the education system. I've worked in school governance for many, many years now. And we often have this argument that we see two personas for people now. There is an analog self and a digital self. And to Alice's point, the demarcation between those two is becoming very, very blurred. As adults, children look up to us for a moral, ethical compass and direction in terms of what's good, bad, and indifferent in the world. The challenge that you have, which will be fixed over time but isn't being fixed now, is that the old are very good at teaching children how to be streetwise in the analog world, but are not very good at doing that in the digital world. And what happens then is that peer group look to each other for support, and that creates a really dangerous situation. And I think we're just storing up some problems for the future, to be honest with you. And, you know, there is much more that education and academia need to do, but there's much more that we need to be doing at a domestic level to try and bring this up. But at the moment, I mean, you know, my two, one's just gone to university, the other one's just doing A-levels. They don't have the same worries and concerns about online privacy that we would have liked them to have. They just think very, very differently about it. So I think, you know, the shout out to education, academia, and the shout out to governments and regulators is we need to listen to that cohort and understand how they think and feel, and factor that into the direction that we need to take things like preservation of privacy and, you know, the protection of rights and freedoms. It's a really important area, and we're still learning. I mean, AI is going to change the gameplay, the battlefield once more, and it's just a constant game of cat and mouse. So yeah, I do worry about it.
Yeah, because I think one of the maybe defenses, but I'm not sure if it is that those big social media platforms are changing, and that now it's becoming obvious that they're fracturing in many ways, and that, you know, reading something the other day, it suggested that those big influencers have become the new broadcast media, and that's what people follow. They don't go on Facebook, they follow Taylor Swift, or they follow Mr. Beast, or God forbid, Andrew Tate, or someone like that, and that's what defines their view of the world. And that's a different kind of thing. But again, I think, Alice, yeah, I think there's dangers there, and I don't know that, I'm certainly not the best person to tell my kids about that, but I don't know who they would turn to. And I don't know, as the youngest person here, Alice, what do you do? Are you worried about this? What it's done to you? Has it changed your habits reading that book?
I certainly am, yes. I mean, even this morning when I was driving to London and I was looking at speed cameras and things like that, and also when I tapped to get on the tube and it said Google Pay, and I was just very aware of everything that I do being tracked. I was using Google Maps to drive and I tapped in with Google Pay to get on the tube, and it is tracking everything that I do. And I was aware of that, but this gave me more of a conscious awareness of it and the implications of what that means. You know, I might get an advert for a coffee because they know I'm right next to a coffee shop and things like that. I think the difficulty is, you know, we're all working in cybersecurity and we struggle to articulate it and know what the solution is. So people who don't work in this industry, it's even more difficult. And the thing with Shoshana's book, as amazing as it is, as I said, it's quite dense and academically written in tone because it has to be, but that makes it a little bit inaccessible. And I'd be interested to know what you guys' thoughts are about things like terms and conditions, which take on average 45 minutes to read for every single thing that we use. What is the solution there, do you think?
Yeah, I just click straight past them and then do what the hell I want. But I use a lot of ad blockers and all kinds of things like that. But I think, to be honest, that's theatre. I don't know that it actually makes difference. Yeah, I don't, but I do what I can to make me feel better, but I don't know whether it actually stops any of my data leaking out anywhere.
I think the change that's required is at a very, very high level. You know, organisations create those T's and C's knowing full well that they're not going to be read by the vast majority of people, and they hide behind them. They exploit the fact that they're big and chunky and weighty and written in legal language that doesn't appeal or resonate with the vast majority of consumers. Now that exploitability needs to be addressed. That's only going to be addressed through the assertion of regulatory standards that compel the transparency to be put in place. Well, we are some way away from that ever happening. In the meantime, you've got these, you know, these privacy lobbyists and so on and so forth. You know, people like Max Schrems doing, great work to try and open the eyes to what's going on. But that change needs to be driven from the top, as it is in any organization, really. And I just can't see that happening quickly. So in the meantime, it's down to us to be situationally aware of these things.
Especially if the data is being used by politicians and governments. Yeah. If they're actually working with these big tech companies and they want that data, then it's not in their interest for us to be aware of it and not opt into them being able to share that data with third parties, e.g. the government.
Exactly that, yeah.
I'm going to be humbug here. We find ourselves, certainly in Paul's case and my case, a few decades on, having similar conversations around how we're actually going to address this problem. And I think the problem here is, even if we were to identify a solution today, we would be building a solution for the past and not necessarily the future. And what concerns me, if you think about the future of this data just continuing to be collected, and it's either in the cloud or it's being held by governments or it's being held by tech companies or whoever it might be. If you think about the growth of generative AI and you think about what's going to be happening with quantum computing in the next 10, 20 years, it is, we're on the periphery of that. And I think the problem is only going to get considerably worse. And so, maybe our conversation should be around how are we going to solve this problem over the next 5 to 10 years, as opposed to what the current state the situation looks like today, because I don't think it's very hopeful at the moment that we're going to have a solution in the short term. I think, Paul, going back to your point about, the younger generation.
Yeah.
If you just think, as human beings, we are naturally overly confident. So the challenge I think you've got with the younger generation is they're confident, probably overconfident about the current state of the landscape in this particular case. And so whether they've got an understanding of or not, there seems to be an acceptance of it. Their level, their threshold for their privacy being invaded is probably very different to ours of our generation. And so, I don't actually know what the future will look like. And that's probably your responsibility, Mark, as, being involved in Threat Horizon to try and continue to help educate all of us on, what the next 2 or 3 years looks like and how that's going to evolve. Because I think this is going to be a really big challenge in over the next 3 or 4 years. And I don't think we will solve it. I think we'll just constantly be catching up, as Paul said.
I think just picking up on what you said there, it's you're right. Children have a laissez-faire attitude towards privacy, but they can be motivated. I mean, children are genuinely concerned about climate change, and that's something that's happened in the past, and they know that they need to affect change. So with the right motivations, they can get behind and change. I just don't think it's a bit like businesses trying to grapple with why cybersecurity is so important. If they don't understand what's in it for them or not in it for them, it's hard to get behind or not get behind. And I still think we haven't hugely quantified or qualified what this is or is not going forward. And I think your second point is absolutely bang on the money. And we've talked about this in Threat Horizon many, many times over. The idea, and I am contradicting myself by saying this, the idea that LegReg is going to catch up and show us the way, it's back to front. LegReg is always struggling to keep up with digital transformation. You've only got to watch when US Congress brings Zuckerberg and the other big tech people in front of them and they ask them daft questions which really call out their naivety and lack of knowledge of something that they're trying to preside over. So whilst, you know, we favour a top-down approach and drive some consistency in how we regulate this, we know that we're never really going to get there.
No, I think politicians are famous for being bad with technology. There's a few among their number that are familiar with some aspects of technology, but it tends to be a generation ago. And, you know, was it Tony Blair was saying, "Oh, I never read an email." And I mean,
wow.
So it's just sort of scary, really. But moving on. So there, Paul, you chose The Culture Map by Erin Meyer. So I guess maybe does that address some of these problems, just that different people do different things in different ways?
Well, it's an interesting one. So, you know, I ummed and ahed about what book to bring to the table. And I ended up bringing this one for two reasons. One, it was a gift from an ISF member for speaking at one of their events. And I was very, very grateful for that. Two, I looked at it and read it and thought, oh, this has got a lot of relatability to some of the work I'm doing on leadership and strategy. And it absolutely has. So a bit about Erin Meyer. Been around for a while. She's an American author and professor of cultural management at INSEAD in Paris, which is an international management school. And she is generally seen to be a bit of an authority on cross-cultural management. And this book is actually about 10 years old. I think it was published in 2014. And the premise of the book focuses on something that we've talked about a lot in the ISF, which is the importance of matching pitch with your stakeholder, and kind of comes back to some of the stuff we've been talking about here. Erin looks at it from a geographical perspective. So if you're working in a big global organization and you're working across geographical and cultural boundaries, there's a challenge because we all think and feel in slightly different ways. And Erin has visualized this by creating the culture map. And the culture map is a system of 8 scales, which can be used to demonstrate how different cultures vary on a scale from one area to another. And it breaks down into 8 areas, which are communicating, evaluating, persuading, leading, deciding, trusting, disagreeing, and scheduling. Now, she brings these to life through lots of personal anecdotes where she's been placed in particular situations and she's seen the differences in cultures and how that can impede or enable or enhance different levels of communication. And I found that really, really thought-provoking, and it brought me back to the challenges that technology leaders have talking to business leaders. Because again, culturally, they're at cross purposes with each other. They're talking different languages. And therefore, there's a lot that I could take away and reflect on in the context of security leaders. It requires a lot of patience to understand. And she goes on to say, you know, through the learnings in the book, if you think about this in the context of stakeholder management, think about where your different stakeholders sit on the culture map and start to recognize the differences in the way that you act and think and feel and communicate with them, and start to factor that into the way that you communicate. For example, the way that we communicate via email versus phone or versus face-to-face. If the culture is relationship-based, email is not a great way to build a relationship. You should start with something more informal, something that's face-to-face, something that's in person. And then when you've established a degree of trust and a way of working between each other, then you can move to these more direct methods of communication, such as email. And this is something that, you know, I see time and time again where I'll talk to security leaders and they'll say, well, the business just doesn't get it. And you say, well, talk to me. Tell me how you're talking to them. And they talk to you and you say, that in no way reflects the way that they think and feel. You've not done any of the homework in the background and thought about what motivates that stakeholder, where they are on the planet. You know, like, for example, Americans are very direct, whereas in other parts of the world, such as Asia-Pac, for example, they like to talk around the subject, and you have to bring in things like body language and expressions and tone of voice and start to insinuate what they're trying to say. And all of these things have a bearing in the way that we communicate. And the final thing that I would say is, as I said, Erin wrote this book in 2014. The thing that's really made me think long and hard is we've just been through a global pandemic. And I was a global CISO through a pandemic in a brand new organization. And all I had to communicate with my stakeholders was a new piece of technology that the vast majority of us didn't really understand. If I had read this book prior to that, maybe the way I would have engaged, albeit through 21st century technology, would have factored in some of the considerations that I now know and understand. And maybe my approaches would have been different. So I think just in summary, this is a book that I wouldn't just say is for security leaders. I think it's for anybody working in information security and risk management who is struggling to understand the motivations and the needs of their stakeholders. And just to take it to another level, just think about how that person thinks and feels and just recognize that we're all different. And actually, it's about leveling that playing field. It's about matching pitch. That's what I took out of that. It's a great book.
Yeah, I had a quick look at it, and one of the anecdotes was about British people and how reticent we are, and how, you know, often we don't give the praise, and just it was just that cross cultural mistranslations that mess things up. And I think we absolutely do inhabit different cultures. You're trying to get at that very much in leadership. I don't know, Mark, do you see that in sort of organizations you work with, just that, you know, one of the jobs you're doing is acting as a diplomat and a translator?
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like for at least 20, 30 years, we've been talking about, you know, the need to communicate effectively and articulate. And I think, Paul, you're alluding to some traits there around empathy and actually trying to look at things from the perspective of the other person, which, of course, is something we do very much on the research side when we're writing reports. So it really is, you know, that's embedded in our thinking in the ISF. And because we've got a global membership, it means we are engaging with different cultures. So I think it's natural for us in the ISF team to think like that. But I just wanted to highlight something which I think is probably relevant here as well. That book, Paul, is on my reading list, which continues to grow day by day. But I did read a book a few months ago, which she co-authored with Reed Hastings, who founded Netflix, called No Rules Rules. Now, this is quite interesting from a culture perspective, because Netflix have an operating model of ultra transparent, a little bit like Bridgewater Associates. And No Rules Rules means they don't have an expense policy, they don't have a holiday policy, because of how they've built the company and what they expect from their staff. They don't need these things. But it's interesting, Paul, when you talk about, you know, these different cultures, because Netflix, when it's had to set up operations in different parts of the world, they've had to deal with what you've described, Paul. You know, in Asia, there's a very different way of working in Europe to the US, etc. And I think it does highlight the fact that whatever role we play in helping organizations manage cyber risk, we've got to take into account not just the culture, but the fact that there is a great deal of diversity in organizations. And when you're talking to the board, that's often a different engagement with the executive committee and the audit committee, to the business owners and the asset owners, all the way through to technology people, security people, risk people. So I will read that book, but I think, you know, my learnings, Paul, from, you know, the summary there is we need to continue to think about the collective group of people that we're engaging with. It's not just about us and who we're reporting to, it's our teams. And then it's the people who we're actually engaging with, and understanding what does the world look like from their perspective. Because when you understand that, you can communicate far more effectively.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've noticed through my years of working in cybersecurity, certainly in a leadership space, is sometimes teams in security can be left to their own devices. And, you know, I'm not picking on any particular group, but I am going to pick on risk management teams, because I think they tend to sometimes see the world through a risk register. And rather than look through the lens of a risk register, what they need to be doing is taking that learning, that listening and that empathy, and just taking a moment to understand exactly what it is the business does, you know, what motivates them to get up in the morning, what are their challenges, what are their hopes and fears, and then look back through the risk register to the risk management processes. And actually, that can be a real eye-opener. And it's something that should be encouraged in all security teams. It's very easy for tech people to work in a silo, but technology has become so intertwined with the day-to-day fabric of business that it just can't work like that. That's a 15-year-old mentality. Mm-hmm. Technology people have to recognize that the only reason they are there is because the business exists. So if you don't understand what the business is trying to do, you can't add the value that you think you're adding. And it's just vitally, vitally important. And you're absolutely right. I mean, with organizations like Netflix being so incredibly globalized now, this is something that they just have to do, or they're going to fail. It's as simple as that.
I'll just say, Paul, I think if we were in the same studio, you would be kicking me under the table as you picked on that particular group. But I think it's absolutely right. Whatever group it is, we exist to serve the business. And, you know, it is about understanding the business, how the business operates. But, you know, a lot of organizations that we work with globally still have a challenge in engaging with the business and starting the conversation. You know, we talk a lot of cliches around elevator pitches and different approaches we should take. But ultimately, we've got to have that conversation. We've got to have more conversations, and we've got to have effective conversations where we're having one single conversation as opposed to what I often observe is two different conversations taking place between two different people.
So something that book has made me think of as well is that recently I was having a conversation about sustainability and the parallels with cybersecurity and how they're seen as separate things. And it's because of the goals of the business are all around profit. And so if the CEO is focused and the CFO are focused on profit making, then the CSO, which is a new role for sustainability specialist, or CISO, cybersecurity, then they're always at odds with each other. Whereas if the CFO and the CEO are also seeing sustainability and cybersecurity as business goals, then they'll be intrinsic to everything. Whereas at the moment, they're kind of working against each other, which makes them difficult.
I think you raise an interesting point here, and incidentally, the role of ESG and cybersecurity is something that's on the Leadership Insights backlog, because it is a topic that we need to talk about. But again, this comes back to outcomes and motivations. You know, boardrooms over the years have become relatively successful because they unify to achieve a common goal, whereas historically, security's kind of sat outside of that circle, and therefore, the risk is that you put yourself in conflict with what it is they're trying to do. If I'm managing risk all the way down to zero, when all the company wants to do is be really, really agile, then you're not aligned to outcomes. Similarly, if a CFO was only interested in EBITDA and the COO and the CEO strategy was for growth at any cost, again, immediately you're conflictory. So the importance of everybody understanding what that unified outcome or goal is, and then thinking about how they bring, you know, what they bring to the party is absolutely critical. And I think that's just a pivot on the whole idea of you've got to be talking the same language or be on the same planes or understand each other's motivations before you can collectively add value to a target or objective. But the sustainability is a really interesting topic, and it is one that members are asking for, and we will be picking that up.
I do think there's a lot of similarities there. Every time I'm working on anything to do with sustainability, the conversation is basically the exact same as what's happening in cybersecurity.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I certainly, doing the governance work last year, there was a lot of people I talked to who all of a sudden had some other responsibilities on the ethical side. And, you know, that definitely crosses over with some of that sustainability stuff. It's sort of, why are you doing those things? You know, and that's bigger questions for the organization, but it goes fundamentally to their culture. And why, you know, what they're in business for. And I think that's going to be really difficult for a lot of organizations, because most of them are there to make money and they really like to make more money. And there was an interesting case recently where there was a software company that used AI, of course, to understand what prices the market would bear for rental properties in, I think, a couple of cities in the US. So they're effectively finding the pain level for all those tenants. And why wouldn't you do that? You know, why wouldn't you want to maximize your profits? But, you know, they've ended up in court because it's seen as unfair, using those tools to exploit people in that way. But yeah, that's an ethical question for an organization. Is that what you want to do? And it's a sustainability question as well, because it may not be sustainable in the long run.
It does call organizational motivations out into the open air a little bit. I do recall The Economist did some research on this tail end of last year, and they, I'm paraphrasing here, but they basically called out that a lot of the big organizations were championing the cause of ESG, but the number and proportion of those that were doing something actionable and tangible was very, very, very low. And that generally just kind of calls out that talk is cheap. And, you know, history will probably judge those organizations. But, you know, at the end of the day, if the motivation is to make money, are you really going to be interested in ESG? Or should you be interested in ESG as a composite of that? And it'll be interesting to see if The Economist ever rerun those numbers to see whether that's leveling out a little bit or whether it stayed the same.
Yeah, I think there's some interesting, like I say, cultural and just approach changes. I think it might be a generational thing as well, because I think, you know, there's a lot of, again, conversations we've had with a lot of ISF members about problems they're facing, and younger people coming into the organization have a very, very different, that's an absolute cultural change. and they want to see the organization do better things or different things. And it's an open question as to how whether that organization takes that on, because at some point those people are going to be managers. They're not the new hires. They're going to be the ones in charge.
Yeah, I think what will happen is, you know, the future will tell, and it'd be interesting if The Economist does cover that. But there's already increasing coverage of greenwashing and how organizations are, you know, they're talking about this, they're not actually doing. But at the end of the day, organizations are going to look at what their priorities are. We touched on profitability there, I think. The one thing that comes up in a lot of conversations with chief risk officers, chief financial officers, when we're talking to them, is it's not just about profitability, it's also about liquidity. And that's probably more linked into the sustainability piece. So, you know, what does the short to long term health of the company actually look like? And I think that that plays a part in, you know, how you look through this through a risk lens to make sure the business does understand how do they prioritize the things that they're doing to meet their goals. And I still think there's a long way to go on the ESG front.
I heard a stat the other day that said if the top 100 companies made changes, we wouldn't be in the climate crisis that we have today. So yeah, that would make a huge difference. And I think that maybe it comes down to tax and fining basically companies that don't do it, because they are going to ultimately be driven by profit. And so if they're, you know, in order for them to make those changes, maybe it needs to come at a cost if they're not making them.
But equally, there's some US states that are now punishing companies that commit too strongly to those sustainable goals. So I think, you know, organizations can be caught either way. And yeah, how do you chart a path through those? Well, you can't. You have to decide.
So why are they being fined for?
Because they're because those states have political structures that do not believe in climate change or human climate change.
It's got to come back to politics, hasn't it? I mean, yeah, you know, I'm watching the US elections next year with interest. I think if they go in a particular way, that's going to propel the climate agenda.
I think I'm going to watch it from behind the sofa because it's
quite scary.
Anyway, moving on. So the book that I chose has the great title of The Cult of the Dead Cow. And it's by another journalist called Joseph Men. And The Cult of the Dead Cow is a hacker supergroup. And it's a slightly shadowy organization. It occasionally pops up in publicity. And certainly as a journalist, I tried to court some of the members of it because they were massively influential. They defined the way that security researchers acted, the ethics, the culture, and certainly the way they operated. And they encouraged a very open, transparent, and sort of disclosure-led way of doing that research. And that book, because I talked to a few of the members of that group, and talk to a lot of other security researchers as well. That book just put everything in place. It's basically a history of the Cult of the Dead Cow group. And it was just fascinating to see how that group changed. And, you know, it started off as a small, very select group, self-selecting group in some respects. And then as the internet changed and became the web, and as that grew, then it became undermined by its own success in some respects. And there were splinter groups and offshoots and now I think its influence is definitely waning, but it was just fascinating to me because, like I say, I've talked to a few of those people, reported on a lot of the incidents they were involved with, and just it was fascinating to look behind the curtain and go, oh, those guys, that's who did that, all right. And then those people have popped up all over the place, and now some of them are absolutely, I think some of them worked for the White House in sort of senior cyber roles or Microsoft. They're the wizards behind the curtains in some respects. Really fascinating book.
No, it puts me in mind of going back to the 80s, you know, the days of people like Captain Crunch and the 2600 magazine and Bulletin Board.
All those guys.
It was an amazing time. I hadn't even realised that was still going forward. I mean, I've got that book. It's sat in my study waiting to be read. So definitely going to have to prioritize.
Well, I reread it for this, and it didn't land with quite the same power as it did first time because it was that revelatory. Oh, that guy. There's a lot of moments like that while reading it, but it's still a good read. It gets a bit, and then she said, he said, they did, he did towards the end because it's a history of things. But it makes sense of a lot of history of the early internet and certainly here security history as well.
I think it's for me, it's just I'm having flashbacks to when Cult of the Dead Cow was a very prominent name up there with some others at the time. I think, you know, for me in my career, it's not, I'll have to read it to remind myself of, you know, the story and maybe fill in some gaps. But I think, you know, many of us maybe at our stages of our careers have gone through various eras of different things that we focused on. And, you know, certainly Paul and myself are operating in a leadership space where we're talking to boards and we're talking to executive committees and non-executive directors. So it's a very different conversation today. But I think, like the first principles book by Rick Howard, it sounds like it's a book that would fill in some gaps or bring people up to speed on, okay, what did the 1980s and the 1990s look like as a precursor to the landscape that we're dealing with today, which I think is actually significantly different to what it was back then.
They've shaped it definitely, and it's different, but it's still, there's a lot of security by obscurity out there. There's a lot of people trying to get away with things. I think that's very true of security companies. That's their main shtick, was trying to hold people to account and trying to improve the world, which is quite a noble aim, even if sometimes it got diverted by realities.
Well, they probably struggled with, hackers. What were hackers back in the 80s and 90s? You know, they were no more than electronic vandals. You know, the idea, even some of the early viruses like Cascade or Form, you know, they were written like pieces of graffiti. Like, people wanted them to be seen. You know, the notoriety was there. I mean, the late Steve Gold and Robert Schifrin and the Prince Philip Prestel hack, you know, we all looked at that and went, wow. Joe Public didn't bat an eyelid. It wasn't particularly interesting back then at all. And, you know, the world has massively changed. We now have the idea of hackers that are a force for good and hackers that are a force for evil and hackers that sit somewhere in the middle, the idea of black hats, white hats and grey hats, you know. So the world around us has changed. So, you know, whereas the cult of the cow have been trying to do the right things and almost create some semblance of internal regulation of that community, they've had to deal with the fact that, and again, this comes back to the challenges of business, is the general public just didn't understand who they were and what they stood for. So they've had a quite a tough time of it. So you got to kind of put themselves on the map.
And then, quite a few people wanted to keep the faith, wanted to keep it pure, didn't want to make any money out of it. And then there were other people who accidentally or by design did make a huge amount of money out of it and became very influential, is the wrong word, but sort of significant for other reasons that those old style hackers didn't really rate. You're influential because you've got a big company, you've got a lot of money. Does that matter? It was very pure in that respect. They're engineers first and foremost.
Well, this is it. A lot of great security researchers aren't in it for the money. They're in it for the kudos. I mean, you know, organizations that have set up bug bounting, and I've written some bits and pieces on this in the past as well, but with a lot of them, although of course it's a great way for these people to turn their interests and hobbies into something that you know feeds and waters them, absolutely. But for a lot of them, it's just they just want to be acknowledged that they did a good thing, and actually that notoriety is just as important as making a few quid. Whereas others just want to monetize it for good and for bad. I do wonder how some of the more modern, more prolific, more notorious groups like Anonymous have taken their cues from the behaviours and the teachings and the work of organisations like the Cult of the Dead Cow. I just wonder whether they see them as influential in the way that they think and feel, or whether
in some respects they're keeping the faith because they are trying to expose some of those problems and some of those, you know, they are trying to do, I guess, in some respects, trying to do the right things. But there's a lot of hacktivism out there that is not as well aimed, that's for sure. Yeah, I think it was just fact. Yeah, I mean, things have moved on enormously, and I think that's why it's a less relevant book now, because unfortunately, those guys don't have the pull the call that they used to.
I think the thing that's quite interesting with all of these is that those communities, and if you go back historically, those communities, they do stand and protect each other. There is a huge body of knowledge in those groups and communities as well. And, you know, they want to do the right things. But for as long as government and law enforcement can't control them, they will potentially be personified as adversarial and threats. And again, they, you know, that's something that they've had to deal with for many, many years. I mean,
it's less true now that it was, but yeah, it's definitely still there.
Yeah.
One question I did want to ask, and to be honest, I'm possibly risking ridicule by asking this, but hey, why should today be any different? So when you choose your books and things like that to read, do you ever sort of imagine that you're trying to justify that choice at all? I don't know why I do this, but occasionally I sort of imagine I'm on a talk show or something like that and someone's asking me questions about it. And because I think I find it very hard to read anything uncritically. And I often find myself trying to explain to this imaginary interviewer, maybe on Desert Island Discs or something like that, that I'm justifying that. I just don't know. As a book reader, do you, Mark, do you do that, Paul? Alice, do you ever think, why am I reading this? And then try and go through that dialogue of trying to explain it to yourself.
Personally, no, because it might be your background in journalism, but for me, reading is like a thing that I do because I absolutely love it. And I do write. I love writing as well. But I read all kinds of different things, all different topics. And I think I enjoy binge reading something that might just be a lovely, easy novel that I can devour. And actually, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism definitely isn't a lovely, easy novel that I could devour. But, you know, I think I read because I'm interested in learning. And actually, that book particularly asks more questions than it answers. And it's great for inquisitive minds. And that's exactly what I read for, is to learn and be exposed to different things, I think.
Yeah, maybe it is a journalism thing. Maybe, yeah, or just I'm possibly arrogant and think one day I will end up on a show like Desert Island Discs.
No, I think from my perspective, Mark, I have a very broad range of topics that I read. And the more I read, the more topics I discover. And then that just gets wider and wider. So
it never ends.
Yeah, I think more of my books are actually business or leadership focused or psychology. So behavioral economics. If you think of Daniel Kahneman, Richard Thaler, those, you know, Cass Sunstein, those are examples of books that I read a lot, but I'll quite often get interested in a particular topic and then read up on something and then see a lot of parallels with, you know, what we do in cyber risk, information risk management. So what I have learnt the more I read and spending time with other authors is, if a book isn't delivering, you should move on to the next book, because time is short.
There's plenty
to read out there. But I, you know, for all the listeners of the podcast, you know, we're interested in knowing what books you're reading. Because, you know, my list is ever growing, and, you know, Paul and I are often sharing ideas.
Do you know what? I have just had a great thought. Because for those that don't know, Desert Island Discs is, you know, you're cast away on an island and you have to choose music in that case. But should we do a version for security leaders, and what would we call it?
Wow.
Desert Island Risks.
Ooh,
mic drop.
Very good.
Thank you.
Wow. And I saw that literally come into your brain. I could see in your eyes that just popped in.
Would that work?
Hey, look. Let's try it.
We could, couldn't we? Because we do regularly talk to CISOs. That'd be a great way to structure. Anyway.
Also, I think it's a great way to discover people is through their books. I think I said it to you in Rotterdam, Mark, that one of my favorite ways to get to know people is through asking them to give me their favorite book. And it might be a book I would have never chosen, but it gives me a huge insight. And I'm sort of reading it through their lens as well.
Yeah. No, that is a brilliant idea. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It gives us that insight, doesn't it? And there could be those lessons they learned that they would take to the desert. I mean, what matters the most? Because I think with that radio show, you get a choice of the works of Shakespeare or the Bible, but we'd also be more liberal than that.
There's a podcast guy by the name of Neil Pasricha. I think it's called, the podcast is called 1001 Books, and he interviews people in the book industry. They could be librarians, they could be authors, they could be booksellers, and he asks them what is their most formative book. So that's something we could also explore, because there is one book, I think we might have covered this on a previous podcast, but there is one book that I will always tell people to read. So, you know, maybe we should explore it on this podcast or on the next one that we cover on books.
I think we should do another book.
Let's leave it as a cliffhanger. Yeah.
Tune in next time for even more on InfoSec books. I want to say thank you for listening. Thank you to Alice. Thank you to Paul. Thank you to Mark for acquiescing so well to this topic. It's been fabulous and fascinating. And we hope you enjoyed this installment, and we hope that you also enjoyed the holiday season. No matter what your faith, creed, or guidance you seek over the holidays, be that NIST, CSF, ISO, or praise be SOGP, it's so good it has that word in the title. Then we hope it gives you solace in these dark times and guide you towards a better place of comfort. And we'll see you in 2024.